Funding for the Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's healthcare needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
You're listening to The Spark. In this portion of the show, we have Miller Hoffman, the director of the Pride and Gender Equity Center, also known as the Page Center at Shippensburg University. Good afternoon, Miller. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much.
I'm glad. So you are the director at the Page Center. Could you explain to us what the Page Center is?
The Page Center is a center at Shippensburg University that has merged the programming and the priorities of what was the Women's Center with the programming and priorities and activities of the Pride Center. And so Pride and gender equity is bringing together a lot of activities, programming, education, student resources, et cetera, that have some overlap and some connection, and then also in many ways are distinct. I think of it as a few different branches of work that sometimes connects to each other and informs and overlaps.
You're the director there. What got you involved with the Page Center?
I've been organizing and active around queer and genderqueer community grassroots work, protest, civil rights. I've been doing that work in three states and several cities. I was in New York City and New York State. I was active in Frederick, Maryland, and in some of the suburbs of D.C. I had a church, Metropolitan Community Church in Maryland. And so I've been very active with queer and genderqueer organizing and activities, grassroots work, community work for 25 years, and have also had a long sort of trajectory with some of the work and the priorities associated with the Women's Center, which are, in our case, we do a fair amount of work with sexual assault and domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And I've come from centers in New York State and in Pennsylvania that support survivors, do trauma-informed, survivor-centered work. And so a lot of that is coming into play in my role at the Page Center at Shippensburg University as well.
So you told us that it was kind of a new branch, the Page Center. How did you all know that it was necessary to do that there?
The Page Center is a new merging, and the Pride Center is more recent. I would say that's a few years, a handful of years or so in the works. The Women's Center is longstanding and has a long history, a lot of programming that was in place, strong programming. Some of that was shifted. Some of it was interrupted with COVID and with some always personnel staffing transitions. And so what's happening now at the Page Center is work, again, that's being connected and merged, and that piece of it is new, but much of the work that's happening there has been ongoing. Some of the Pride Center work before there was a Pride Center was activity and energy that was driven by a coalition or a council of staff, faculty, and students, an offshoot of one of the PASHE-wide faculty committees that was helping to ensure that concerns related to gender, sexuality were being addressed and protected and cared for.
Miller, campus life comes with a lot. And you said there was a Women's Center, a Pride Center, and now the Page Center that's like all-encompassing of everything you just said. Why was that support necessary to students? Because, you know, students don't just go to class. you know, they have like connections, they build relationships. Like, why was it necessary for the students? Like,
these, I think that these departments and these centers are really important. I'm part of one of them. Others would include really important centers like the MSA, the Multicultural Student Association, has just vast, deep, robust programming that is designed to connect students to each other in the ways that we're really unique, in the ways that we're different but tied and share needs and share goals. And that work is really critical for helping students to find community, to find belonging, to feel supported and to feel resourced, to make and build friendships and relationships that are for our well-being, but also promote our success in academics and in our other interests.
You know, and that's so necessary, because when a lot of students go off to campus, it's really a time where they can rediscover themselves. And through these programs, they can feel really comfortable. So I see that with the Page Center, there's been a lot of education programs. Could you talk to us about what education programs you offer there?
At the Page Center, I can. We've got, I think of as a couple of arms or branches of work, and one of them is tied to LGBTQ education and cultural humility, helping folks to understand, both within our communities as well as folks who don't identify as LGBTQ or other queer, genderqueer identities, to help us share language, share experiences so that we can understand. I think the better we know about and talk with each other, the better prepared we are to engage and connect and to build relationship and to build community. Another branch of our educational programming is tied to gender-based violence, what I think about and frame as gender-based violence and power-based violence around sexual assault, intimate partner violence, stalking. And we have an array of activities and programs and work that we're doing for classroom education, events that we do to highlight the survivors and survivors' voices, to help folks understand the real present problems that exist, and that we have a number of ways that we can engage with that, that there is a role for all of us in bystander action, in sort of reframing and redirecting our peers and helping one another think about things differently, changing each other's behavior, and helping to set a tone and create a culture where violence and harm will not be tolerated or excused or overlooked or brushed over, that survivors will be believed and supported, have resources. And another piece of this is around what I think of as reproductive or safer sex or sex education that has ties to each of the other arms, I think, but is about helping folks to find body positive space, sex positive space, so that folks can talk about and think through who they are. Not everybody is engaging sexually. For folks who are, it's an opportunity to have conversations so that people are talking about what they're doing, what they need. And the more we're able to do that with less shame, with less tentativeness, with less fear, the more we're able to get good resources, the more that we're able to talk about what we like and what we don't like, the more consent is happening, the more discussion about what we want to allow and what we don't want to happen is taking place. And so all of these things promote good, healthy sexuality, safer sex, and consent.
Miller, you talked a little about like survivors and making everyone feels safe. You've been the director at the Page Center for some time. Do the students feel safe?
Well, I would have without you asking the specific question, I would have wanted to come back to the word safe. That's not a word that I use. I use the word safer, and we do what we can to create safer space, to encourage safer sexualities, to create safer communities. I think we live, and I think it's ongoing that being safe or saying that a space is safe is difficult to do. And a lot of times folks are focusing on a particular kind of information or education or safety. So, for example, there are programs where folks will talk about queer and genderqueer identity and experience, and then sort of call that as a safe place. And those places aren't always connecting to race, connecting to non-transgender and other harms. And so I really think about these things as safer places and safer practices.
I know at the Page Center, you also have a all gender neutral closet. Could you tell us about that closet?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I want to talk a little bit about the language that you just used. I liked all gender.
Yeah.
Gender neutral, I think, is something to describe. I think it describes something a little bit differently. I think neutral is more of an absence, and all gender is allowing all things to be present. And it's a tiny thing, and it's not a huge deal. And at the same time, I really do love to talk about the words that we use and what they mean and what they mean to each of us. It's something that we do a lot of at Shippensburg University and at the Page Center, at our partner groups like MSA, the Multicultural Student Association. We're talking about and talking with each other a lot about who we are and what our world is and our experiences, and engaging with the ways that we use language similarly and differently. So sorry for that tangent.
No, it's fine. We're here to learn.
So we do have an all gender clothing closet. It's hilarious that we're calling it the closet. There was, you know, some discussion about that, but we decided to do that ironically. And it feels so important. A clothing closet feels so important, and it feels iconic in a lot of ways. Clothing is a really enormous part of expression for so many of us. So we're sort of thinking about gender expression, but it's huge and it's enduring, and it has crossed time and history and location. And I'm thinking about the ways that historically clothing has been used to identify and to sanction groups of people. There are anti-clothing choice laws that date from the 1800s that were employed really particularly in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I think that a lot of us know about three gender-appropriate item laws that were used when we talk about Stonewall, when we talk about Compton Cafeteria, when we talk about sort of some of the energy in the movement in the late 60s.
Could you explain about the energy in the movement?
Yeah, I will. I do want to sort of talk about clothing for a minute.
Okay.
While I'm doing that, there were laws that were established in the United States in the 1800s, and the first was in St. Louis, Missouri, around 1848, and then it sort of exploded. More than 40 U.S. cities followed suit shortly after. And something that I think is really interesting is that language that was being used at the time to create those laws was about clothing not belonging to his or her sex, clothing belonging to the other sex, indecent dress and disguises. And these laws were tied to prostitution, vagrancy, to public drunkenness, to disorderly conduct. And they were tied to things like rural anti-rent protesters, folks coming from farms to protest oppressive sort of rent prices. They were used against feminists and feminist clothing reformers, women and other folks asserting that they should be able to wear pants rather than dresses, as well as them being applied to a range of gender-bent practice. And this feels really important to me because it's a part of our history that as queer and genderqueer folks around drag, around trans expression, that sometimes we know about. And so with Stonewall, with Compton, with those things, it was that was about folks sort of carving out safer space to find community, to find connection, and being targeted by sort of social norms and social folks trying to control social order, which is what a lot of these laws are about. And that energy sort of bubbling up around a similar time so that some changes started to happen. And I think that what folks don't always, we don't always know that history about ourselves, but we also really don't always know that historically these laws were used to tie together different forms of oppression. They went hand in hand with Jim Crow segregation laws. They went hand in hand with restrictive immigration laws. So this control of social order was combining a number of things, doing harm to a number of groups, combining anti-trans and anti-women, right? Combining anti-trans and anti-immigrant, which feels really important to us as a community. It feels very important to us as a campus and the work that we do, again, with MSA and some of our other friends and partners and colleagues there. And for all of these reasons, clothing, you know, something as simple as a all-gender clothing closet where students can come and get free clothes and just browse. Nobody's sort of attending to the materials. Folks can browse, try things on. Students are coming across sexuality and gender. Sort of lots of different folks are in there. And they are able to experiment with expression, whatever that is. They're able to get free things. Even secondhand shops are becoming more expensive. They're able to participate in sort of reduce, reuse, recycle, right, of already existing resources. And then something that I really love about the clothing closet is that it serves as a entry point. It serves as a bridge to the many other resources that we have available, whether that's menstrual products, contraception, and so forth, whether that's support, confidential support and resources, advocacy around gender-based and power-based violence. And one of the things that's lovely about a clothing closet is that in community and in community affinity groups, trans affinity groups, it's really lovely and it's common for trans folk to swap or to exchange these gendered items, things like ties and, yes, and heels. And it's a way for us to connect to one another and to be together as a community. And it's something that the Page Center, I'm finding, is possible sort of across gender and across sexuality, that folks are coming in for clothing, folks are coming in for menstrual products or for contraception, and finding ties to and overlap with other groups that are using the space and connecting in the space. And I'm hoping that that will continue to grow and that it will continue to be known for the work that we're doing there.
When is the all-gender closet available?
It's open. Really, it overlaps almost perfectly with when the building itself is open. We're okay. Housed in the Cub, and it's kind of a central student activities building on campus. And our hours, we try to have our spaces available as much as possible when that Cub is open.
How has the response been from the students?
I have found that students are very regularly using the resources that are there. The clothing closet is something, again, it's newer. It was started around the time of the Pride Center, which was just in the last few years, but it was well used. I think it was well known on campus. Some of our other programming that we're kind of rebuilding post-COVID, the word is getting out, and so we're noticing growth and more folks coming and taking advantage of those. And we just continue to hope that that moves forward and continues to grow.
Can anyone donate clothes to the all gender neutral closet? And is there like things that, like pieces of clothing that you would rather folks donate?
I think that we have a certain capacity, right? We've got a limited space. I do want to mention that our First Lady, Colleen Patterson, the president's partner, is a regular donor, is a good supporter, folks appreciate the quality of the clothing that folks are donating. But what we're not able to use for any reason, we are also sharing with some of the other folks in Shippensburg, like Katie's Place, like the SCRC, the Shippensburg Community Resource Center, and other folks. So it's not as though if somebody wanted to bring some clothing by and we weren't able to use it, it would still be able to be used and get passed on.
Well, thank you so much, Miller, and thank you for listening. Remember to like our Facebook page, The Spark, to stay connected with us. You can also listen to this interview again on our website at WITF.org. Just go to All Programs and click The Spark. Happy Thursday, and we hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much, Miller.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.